Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
You guys, I am so excited. My new course on behavior, the Practical Behavior Approach, is officially done and ready to go. Enrollment is only open until April 30th. And if you are someone who is supporting a child with frequent challenging behaviors, listen in because this course is for you. This course was designed for any teacher, special ed or gen ed, clinician or parent working with a child with frequent negative behaviors. This course is going to prepare you with a comprehensive toolbox. You're going to have all the tools you need to prevent problem behaviors, respond when problem behaviors happen, and to build those missing skills. We go in depth into why behavior happens, looking at contributing factors like diagnosis, trauma, anxiety, and sensory needs. This is truly a cohesive course where strategies are rooted in the science of applied behavior analysis, but also rooted in trauma-informed practices. So you're going to have both perspectives to develop this really robust framework of strategies that is truly going to be effective. So if you are feeling burnt out, overwhelmed, or out of answers on how to support your kids, click on the link in the show notes and learn a little bit more about this course and how the training and all of the downloads and tools are going to really help support you on this journey to helping your child be successful. I can't fully express how excited I am to get this course in your hands. Click on the link in show notes. Let me know if you have any questions. And when you get started, let me know how it goes.
Hi, I'm Sasha Long, special ed teacher and board certified behavior analyst. Welcome to the Autism Helper Podcast. I'm here to explore different strategies to improve the lives of individuals with autism.
Welcome back to the Autism Helper Podcast. Today I'm chatting with BCBA and former teacher Amanda Baroche about staff training with behavior plans. Amanda is a fellow former CPS teacher, so definitely understands the complexities of thoroughly and effectively training your team. In this conversation, we go in depth into really why staff training is so important, especially when it comes to our behavior plans, and really the long-lasting effects of not training with fidelity can have on not only that student, but that entire classroom and students in the future. Amanda shares what some of the biggest challenges are and some ways to overcome those obstacles and really get that staff buy-in so behavior plans are implemented the way they were designed. If you have students with behavior plans in your classroom, or if you are a consultant in a public school setting in any way, this episode is for you. There's going to be a lot of actionable things that you can bring back to your role right away. So let's go ahead and hear from Amanda. Hi, Amanda. Thank you so much for joining me.
Hey, Sasha, thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to talk about staff training. I love talking about staff training. We all know how important it is. And today we're really going to dive in with Amanda about staff training with behavior plans. So why is this especially important on this topic of behavior within the school setting to really get your staff on the same page?
Well, consistency of interventions is key. In my experience being in schools, there's often many adults who are interacting with any given student in a day. It could be paraeducators, special education teachers, related service providers, administrators. You've got the, you know, lunch and recess monitors, all of these people who could be interacting with the student. And if after they are starting to implement a plan, if the behavior isn't changing in the desired direction, it's hard to know if the problem was that implementation wasn't being done with fidelity across people or if it's a problem with the intervention. So if we're not able to get everybody on the same page, we may conclude that the intervention is ineffective when really it was the implementation that was inconsistent. This is a really, I would say, like in my experience, very difficult thing to do in the schools, given the number of people who are interacting with the students and then also just the time available to provide that training. So I think that this is a big, I'm glad that you're having this conversation because this is a huge need in the schools in terms of training people to implement behavior plans.
I mean, yeah, when you just listed that, you know, list of people right there, we have teachers, we have paraprofessionals, lunch monitors, administrators. There are so many people that interact with that child every day. And your point is dead on, that it's that inconsistency and then what database decisions are we making? Like, we may decide, oh, look, you know, behaviors didn't change, look at our data, but really, you know, this intervention isn't working, we're going to change to something else. But really, it's that the intervention wasn't even being utilized across the board. So we can really be, I think, like, wasting a lot of time too.
Oh, exactly. And I think you kind of have like two, at least in my experience in schools, you kind of have like two edges of the sword or whatever you want to call it. But like, you've got the one where maybe it's not being implemented with fidelity, so we're changing the intervention too soon. Or maybe people aren't changing the intervention after years of people trying to implement the same thing over and over and over. I know in my last role, when I was a behavior specialist in Chicago public schools, I was often going out to classrooms and working even with like eighth graders, and you look back and they've had the same behavior plan for years. And it's like, well, you've been using these strategies, but the behaviors haven't changed. Why are we still using these strategies? So I think it's both things, getting people on the same page, but also using those data to make decisions sooner than a couple of years later.
And sometimes it's quite literally the same behavior plan, like copy and pasted. And you're like, yes. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. So frustrating. So obviously, you know, big picture, the negative outcome for that child is their behavior is not improving. They're not gaining access to new inclusion opportunities. They're not learning new positive pro-social skills. And they're just kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of, I think, perpetuates placement for students, perpetuates, you know, where what their opportunities are. So in terms of like why we think this is important, this is kind of everything. Because if we don't have this behavior plan working and moving forward, we're really limiting where our kids can go.
Yes. And the other piece of this that I've seen, of course, the outcomes of the student is the most important problem that we want to solve and help, right? But some other things I've seen with this is, if it's not implemented correctly over time and then the behavior doesn't change, I think that this sometimes leads to punishment of like the implementer's behavior. The implementer doesn't want to try to implement new strategies or interventions in the future because it was ineffective, or they think it's ineffective. And so they become more resistant to trying new strategies because in the past, for whatever reason, when they tried something and maybe it wasn't done with fidelity or maybe it wasn't the right intervention for the student, it kind of leads to a problem where they just don't want to try anymore because everything they've tried in the past was at least seen as not working. So this is something that I think is huge. And like when I'm doing consultation, is like constantly checking in on fidelity and on student outcomes, but also on feasibility and working with the staff to be like, is this actually working for you? Like, is this doable? Because if it's not going to be doable long-term, I'd rather have a plan for changing it and get everybody back on the same page again with those changes than I would for there to be inconsistent implementation and things like that. So that's something that I've also seen as a negative outcome when staff aren't thoroughly trained. Not only are the students not making the progress that we'd like for them to see, but also it creates further resistance, I think, from staff if they have bad experiences with implementation.
And that like then bleeds over to other students that they get in the future. You know, this may be 3 years in the future and there's another student. It's like, hey, do you want to try this strategy? And they're like, nope, did that 3 years ago, didn't work. Even though it's a different kid, in their head, it's like, oh no. Like, I mean, I'm sure you've run into teachers like this in your role as a consultant, like even things as simple as like a schedule. They're like, no, I did a schedule before, it didn't work. And you're like, cool. Let's break that down. Like, really, did it not work? Like, or no, reinforcers don't work for him. That's my favorite one. And it's like, okay, let's talk about what that word means a little bit more. But it can really then have this lasting impact on that educator or staff member's role for a while.
And I you know, I also think, especially if you're a consultant in a BCBA, I think we all are kind of familiar with our reputation in some ways in schools as not being great collaborators. And I think, you know, if a teacher's consulting with a behavior analyst and then it doesn't go well, you know, that also can generalize to future interactions with behavior analysts.
For sure.
And I think that like it's, we as behavior analysts in schools really have to be careful with our consultation to make sure that we're providing the, you know, support and stuff that would actually be useful for the teachers so that they find our support actually feasible and helpful rather than just coming in and telling them what to do and then leaving.
Yeah, exactly. I've done this session a few times at ABA conferences and with ABA clinics about, you know, that exact topic and just like being a little nicer when it comes down to it in a non-behavior analytic way. But, you know, it's kind of interesting in our field because I think it's a newer field in schools that if an educator or a staff member meets one not so great BCBA, they're kind of willing to write off the whole field because it doesn't seem like a necessity. You know, we all have met bad doctors, right? A doctor that with bad bedside manner, but we don't like write off medicine because we know how important the field of medicine is, right? And I think there's not yet an understanding of like what the field of ABA can really all bring because of these like negative experiences. So yeah, I mean, it's important on like these huge levels that we want to be really making sure that our strategies work. And part of that is getting staff buy-in and being a collaborative member of that team.
In my experience too, like I kind of, when I started in the role of consulting, I had moved from being a special education teacher. So I actually had an experience on that end of it with receiving consultation from a behavior specialist. And in my experience, that person did not do a great job helping me identify interventions that were feasible for me to implement as a teacher. She was like, you need to have, you know, 8 different individualized token economies. Well, that's too much for me right now. Yeah. You know, and so it kind of gave me like this desire in my consultation role to make sure that I'm always inclusive of the teachers or the practitioners in deciding what we're going to do. And what's actually going to be feasible and implementable. No, that's not a word.
Yeah. No, I get it.
Yeah. So I think that's the hugest like piece is making sure that whatever we're recommending is something that they are willing to do and are able to do and constantly checking in on that over and over.
Yeah. And not to go like too far in a detour on this topic, but I think, you know, your experience having been a teacher, same as mine, coming from a classroom, I really kind of consider myself a teacher first and a behavior analyst second. And I feel like that's really important because the schools are just a different beast, man. Like if you come from a clinic in-home setting and you walk into a school, you just don't understand the logistics there. And logistics rule the world. It's like, hey, it'd be great if this kid had a para to do this or a staff member to do this or a space for that. It's like, yeah, that's all cool. Like we don't have any of that though. Like some schools, there isn't like copy paper. So like what are we doing instead? And I think, yeah, again, if you have interactions with those BCBAs that are like, hey, do a 30-second interval of this. And the teacher's like, no, I haven't gone to the bathroom in 3 months. Like, no, thank you. It's going to even further, you know, create that negative learning history with behavior analysts or these types of strategies.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is, I think, so in my research as a doctoral student and moving into becoming an assistant professor, I have really, really been focusing on how to conduct program evaluation and how to conduct like ecological assessments prior to making any intervention recommendations. And I think that this is kind of a key element that we should be training future behavior analysts to use in the school setting in particular is like conducting observations, not just of the target student that you're interested in, but of the setting of the resources, the materials. We should be using qualitative data by interviewing teachers and paraeducators to truly get a better understanding of what would even be feasible in their setting. And if it's not feasible and they tell you it's not feasible, don't recommend it.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I'm like,
hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah. If you think about like how city planners and architects do their work, they do the same thing, right? Before they like decide to build a building or a bridge, they like look at all of those other factors. And we sometimes like go right into like the bridge or the building. Like we don't think about everything else that's at play.
I love that analogy. Yeah, that's exactly it. And I, you know, kind of the mantra that I've used with schools too is, I'm not married to the intervention or to the recommendation I'm making. I'm married to the outcome for the student. So
that's a great
phrase. If we're trying this and it doesn't work, then we'll change it. That's fine. But we have to try it. We have to make sure we're actually trying it and those kinds of things. But I think sometimes it takes the pressure off, because I think if staff are seeing our support or our training as us thinking that we know everything and that these are always the best practices, rather than seeing it as a problem solving relationship together, that, you know, they're less likely to want to try it. But I always tell people, I'm like, I'm not married to this intervention. If the whatever doesn't work, we'll try something different, but we have to try this with fidelity for a while to see. I'm willing to admit that like what I recommend is wrong if it doesn't work.
Yeah.
So exactly. I think sometimes that kind of takes the pressure off too.
Or like, I think like I'm kind of a people pleaser by nature. So if I was like a young teacher and someone came in and was like, try this and it didn't work, I'd like feel bad, or I'd feel like I did something wrong too. So I think that comment is so key on like, yeah, developing that collaborative relationship.
Yeah.
Okay. So we know this is all so important. Now let's talk about why it's so hard. You kind of touched on this earlier, but this is like all easier said than done. If we had a magic wand to do this, we would all buy this magic wand. But what are first, before we get to like this, the tips for doing this, but what, let's first start with some of the challenges and the obstacles. What makes this whole kind of collaborative staff training process really hard, especially in schools?
Well, I think probably the biggest one that everybody would know that works in schools is the time and the availability to attend training or to receive training. In schools, you need the school to have money to pay for a substitute, to send a teacher or a paraeducator to a full day professional development. You know, that's not cost effective and it's not time effective either for the school, because if you're sending those people out, who's providing the services to the student? And then also the type of professional development that's often offered is either irrelevant a lot of times. I know for me as a special education teacher, for students with extensive support needs, a lot of the PD that we were sent to was completely irrelevant to my needs. You know, all of my students were on alternative state tests, but I was still required to go to meetings about, you know, the regular tests or whatever. And I think that just a lot of the stuff is just ineffective, because the most common type of training that's offered is this like workshop style, like one-time sit and get didactic training. But research has shown over and over and over that that is ineffective at actually changing behaviors in the classroom in terms of how people are implementing. It's missing that experiential on the job component, where there's actually modeling and practice and feedback. So I think that those are some of the most common challenges. And then the other one is paraeducators are the ones who are most commonly with the students all day long. And they are the ones who are least trained often. They sign on and then they're put in the classroom the next day. You know, there's no like onboarding training. And if there is, it's going to be like, here's how you use your benefits. It's not going to be, here's what functional communication training is. Yeah. Or here's how to use a prompting hierarchy. So I think that that is also one of the biggest pieces, is just the people who are in the nitty gritty with these kids all day long are the ones who are least trained and equipped. Of course, they're capable, but they're not being provided those resources. So I think that that's probably one of the biggest challenges.
And schools are so short-staffed right now. I mean, really all over the country. And I used to say that a lot in trainings like 5 years ago. And it's funny that I said it then because it's like so different even now. Like now it's like, oh, you have a pulse and you're a human adult. Great. Here, have a job. Start tomorrow. And you're a one-on-one for this really challenging student. Great. Mm-hmm. And that would feel like a win, honestly, for a lot of schools because they just have so many vacancies. And so it's people walking into positions that are really, really challenging and require a lot of training that have really not even just no training, no experience to even mm-hmm. kind of fall back on. So it puts, I think, a lot of pressure on the teachers in their role to provide that training and then to consultants in those schools to like support those teachers and those other staff members.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know in my experience as a teacher, you know, often I was like, oh my gosh, we need more people. Like physically, we need more people for safety purposes. But I've also been on the other, you know, end of it where I had 5 paraeducators, and that's really challenging as well in its own way mm-hmm. to get 6 of us on the same page. And then you've got interpersonal relationships and like all kinds of things to work through, and it can just be really challenging. And I don't know about you, but in my teacher prep program, I was not ever taught how to train other adults.
No one is. Like, I feel like I showed up as like a 22-year-old in this classroom with 2 paras, and I was like, did I miss this class? Like in undergrad? Like, did I sleep through it? Like, no one really prepared you for like leading and managing adults, which is like its own management is like a degree that you can get. Yes. Like, and like, oh no, you're just supposed to like figure that out. And by the way, your parents are older than you and more experienced, have more years in the classroom, but you now have to like tell them what to do. And it can create this super challenging and I think uncomfortable dynamic for people.
Absolutely. I just actually recently last year published a systematic review looking at all the research to date of special education teachers training or coaching paraeducators. And when I started my PhD, I did so because this was one of my biggest questions, was how do we actually prepare special education teachers to provide that staff training to the paraeducators? Because it's mandated by law that the paras be, you know, trained and supervised by a licensed teacher. But if those teachers are unprepared, then that makes it really difficult. And we did find that it is possible that special ed teachers absolutely can learn to use with fidelity training and coaching practices that improve paraeducators' use of evidence-based strategies. But we also found that those demographic dynamics like you're describing are very common. So in our review, I think it was 96% of the teachers were white females. And then the paraeducators were more likely to be women of color. There were slightly more men, and they were much more likely to be older and have more experience.
Yeah.
So that makes it really challenging as a teacher too, because I'm like, oh, I'm brand new, so I actually don't have that much experience. And my paras have been here for 20 years, so I should probably listen to them. Yeah. And you should, but also, it's a very challenging dynamic, I guess. And so I think if we could like actually explicitly train special ed teachers how to work with paraeducators, it would be really helpful for everybody involved.
What are some strategies that have been successful for you, both, you know, in that teacher role and in that consultant trainer role, on getting staff buy-in, on getting this training process started and going?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll start with the mistakes I made first as a consultant, if that's okay.
Please.
My first probably year in the role of a consultant, and so this was we provided consultation only for students that had IEPs and that were engaging in severe challenging behavior, and they had to have had a behavior plan in place before. So like we were kind of last resort, if you will. And so often I would go out, I would conduct like a 30-minute observation, I would meet with the teacher afterwards and give them a list of all the things I think they should try. And then, you know, maybe follow up 2 weeks later with an email. Let me just tell you, that did not go over well. and you would think that having been a teacher, I would have thought that that wouldn't go over well. But no, for whatever reason, I wasn't able to generalize that. So over time, I really started diving into organizational behavior management and implementation science. And a lot of those, both of those fields really focus on how do you, you know, conduct assessments of the environment, of what's currently being done. How can you identify interventions that are going to be have a strong fit ahead of time? So that's one thing I've done is conduct quantitative and qualitative observations of just what's going on. I also did more observations just than just one 30-minute because I think we all know it's like this, you take the squeaky car to the mechanic and then it stops squeaking.
For sure.
I would go out to a school and they're like, well, that was a really good day. Or that was a really good 30 minutes. That's not how it usually goes. So
it's like the only time as a teacher, you're disappointed when things go well. Cause you're like, damn
yes.
it.
Yes, exactly. I was like, well, I guess that's good, but also I understand. So I started conducting more observations for longer. I started using more statements of just support and praise and, you know, statements of empathy around what the teachers and the paras were struggling with. Because if you go in and you just place a bunch of demands and you have no rapport with these individuals, it's going to be the same outcome as if you were to do that with a client that, you know, has a disability. Like, we don't start intervention sessions with clients by like just starting with demands immediately, right? So
for sure.
We shouldn't do that with adults that we're working with either. So I do, you know, a lot of, and these are genuine statements of empathy because, yeah, like it really sucks when your whole classroom gets destroyed
yeah.
and you've spent lots of money on the stuff that you put in your classroom, or, you know, you had to clear the rest of your kids out for the rest of the day. And so you feel like you didn't get enough face time with them. And like, those are all actually legitimate concerns. So I start by basically trying to understand the environment, understand what they're going through, and trying to pair with them. I try to provide praise on things that I see that are good and interesting. And I also always try to include them in all steps of the process. So I think, you know, using antecedent choice. So if I have a couple of ideas for interventions, I'm going to sit down and be like, here's what I think could happen. We could try this or we could try this. What do you think? And try to get their buy-in from the very beginning. So that's kind of a long-winded answer.
No, that was great.
Of the best thing you can do is be inclusive of the stakeholders from the very beginning, and really try to understand what they're dealing with.
I mean, like you just said, we really have to use the same strategies we use with our students and our clients. Like, we pair, we give choices, we involve them, like, those same things we have to use in that kind of training relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see that? Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry. I was going to say another big one is actually modeling the strategy and testing it out for yourself to see if it is feasible.
Yes.
You know, if you are a consultant, like, it's important for you to go into the actual setting and the actual, you know, environment and try it yourself too. To see if it would actually even be feasible or how the student responds to it. Because again, you run the risk of recommending something that's either not feasible or doesn't work. And then you're unlikely to continue having people being willing to try what you're asking them to try.
And sometimes things make sense on paper. And then when you try it in person, it's like you totally didn't consider one aspect or there's a reaction you didn't expect. And you can flush all of that out ahead of time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when it comes to kind of that teacher-para relationship, do you see that same, those same kind of mindsets and strategies being successful, like the getting the buy-in and the pairing and the giving choices and things like that? Can that all be done within that relationship?
I definitely think it can be. I think it's not an area that's been researched very well yet. When we did our review, all of the research, so I conducted the search for the studies in 2021, and all of the studies that came up had been published in the past 5 years. So this is a very new area that people are focusing on. Are you familiar with practice-based coaching?
Yes. Yeah. Can you tell a little bit about that?
Yes. So practice-based coaching. This is from Snyder, Hemeter, and colleagues. I believe they're at Vanderbilt, but maybe don't quote me on that. I can send a link for like a resource that you could put in show notes or something. But they developed this, and it's a non-hierarchical, cyclical coaching model. And the point is that you don't have some expert telling some non-expert what to do. Rather, you have a pair of people where one person is highly trained in X strategy. Okay. So it doesn't have to mean that they're like the know everything. It's just that they're highly trained in whatever that one thing is. And then you have the coachee, who's the person who needs to learn to use that. And it starts by the coach guiding the coachee through setting a goal, and they do it together. And then they come up with a shared action plan for how they're going to meet that goal. So the coachee tells the coach what they think they might need in order to be successful at meeting that goal. So they might say, like, do you have any videos I could watch of that? Or could you come in the classroom and show me how to do that? And then the coach writes that down, and then they engage in that action plan. And then after the action plan has been done, the coach sets up a time to observe the coachee using that strategy within the typical setting. And then afterwards, they meet and they go through, the coach guides the coachee through reflection on their own implementation. And so the coach does have data from their observation, but it's all focused on that one specific practice that they're targeting. So if it were a special education teacher looking at a paraeducator, perhaps using prompting, that's the only thing that the special ed teacher should be taking data on, and the only thing they should be guiding the coachee, the para, through reflecting on. They shouldn't say, oh, and by the way, don't forget Jimmy has to go to lunch at 12 or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be related to anything else. It's very focused on just that practice. And then it keeps going until the coach reaches, the coachee reaches their goal. So it's a cyclical process. They're both taking action to help improve the implementation of the strategy. And it should be based on what the para in this situation needs. So I think something like that would be really useful for paraeducators and teachers, because of the, you know, it's not just the teacher telling the para what to do.
It feels like more objective too than like personal. I think that can sometimes make a training process a little uncomfortable for both parties, as it feels like, oh, you're telling me what I'm doing is wrong, or this, like, people can have kind of that learning history with this process, but this makes it much more objective. This is something you need to learn. We're focusing on this thing, this strategy here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And giving them a choice ahead of time and saying, yeah, like, okay, we have this behavior plan that has three different components. Which one do you want to focus on first? And then you spend time until the para or whoever is able to implement that component to fidelity. And then you switch to the next goal. It's very objective, it's systematic, and it's frequent. And I think that this is honestly, this pyramidal training model is kind of the answer to a lot of the challenges that we have with training in schools.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I will link that article. I think I have that somewhere on my desktop as well. And I will link that in the show notes. Well, thank you so much, Amanda. I could like chat about this forever, so I don't want to take up too much of your time, but this been really helpful. And I think you've given some great, reasonable, feasible suggestions for the school setting. So thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people go to learn more from you?
I have a website. It's amandaborosh.com. Borosh is B-O-R-O-S-H. And that's my website. There's a way to contact me through there if you have questions about consultation or if there's anything I can do. I do offer supervision and mentorship. So I'm happy to connect with anybody who feels like they might need support in that area.
Great. I will add that to the show notes as well. Thanks, Amanda.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Autism Helper podcast. If you liked what you heard and want to hear more, hit subscribe. It would mean a lot to me if you left some feedback. Whether I'm working one-on-one with a student, doing a podcast like this one, or presenting for a PD, my goal is always to provide as much value as I can. So your feedback really helps me make sure I'm doing just that. If you have other topics you'd like me to cover, leave in the feedback or message me on social media. You can follow me at The Autism Helper on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and Pinterest, or visit my website, theautismhelper.com. Thanks again for listening.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Having the right resources for your classroom is essential to making sure your classroom is running smoothly. At the Autism Helper Shop, we have all of the resources you need to make sure you have the behavior, communication, and curriculum supports for your students. Within our shop, we have adapted books, task cards, resources aligned to the VB map and the ABLES, behavior plan flowcharts, data sheets, curriculum. Everything you need, whether you are an early childhood teacher or a high school teacher, we have all of the resources that will meet those students' needs. So head over to shop.theautismhelper.com to check out all of our resources.